if you like. So anyhow, I was going to concentrate mainly on motivation of these studies, of my studies, on some very important particular features of the studies, some results, and comparison to other determinations of PDFs and comments about the differences. So as you might know, I try to extract PDFs from the DIS data, and motivation of this study is at least twofold. First of all, we very well know that deep inelastic scattering is so-called clean process. In practice, this means that the higher order corrections, QCD corrections, are relatively small. And we can hope that with existing calculations up to approximately next to leading order, we can get more or less reliable estimate of these theoretical errors. Moreover, we have long history of studies of DIS process, and we have a lot of experiments which are more or less comparable between each other. Experimental errors are studied in details for these experiments, and they are documented, they are given in the publications, and so we can totally have this more or less clean theoretical input and clean, more or less clean experimental input. We can hope that from this experiment we can extract more or less reliable pattern distributions necessary for other applications. But there is another goal of these studies. Maybe not, because this is a separate story. You know that infamous story of neutrino experiments, and I wouldn't like to comment it. Maybe at the very end. So when I speak about DIS data, I mean only charged leptons experiment only. An additional goal of this study is to provide PDFs from one single process. Why is it so important? It's important because if we have PDFs extracted from DIS, for example, we can conclusively compare it to other processes in order to understand universality of PDFs. We know very well that they have to be universal if we assume factorization. But we also know that in many cases factorization breaks, and it's interesting to study the mechanism of breaking and so on. And eventually, if you have PDFs extracted from one process and you compare it to other processes, for example, for jet production, you can more conclusively understand effects of new physics. So even if these few reasons were invalid, we anyhow have to extract PDFs. We anyway had to try to extract PDFs from DIS data only. So kinematics of data, which I use in this extraction, is following. I use all available experiments for charged leptons from SLAG, BCDMS, NMC, H1, and Zeus. And this is kinematics of data used in the analysis. A particular feature of data set which I use is that I don't cut relatively low W, which populate this region. In this region, power corrections are important, and in many other studies, this is cut in order to minimize impact of these power corrections. I apply in the fitting procedure, I apply target mass corrections, which are important in this region, and try to fit dynamical height twist turns, which can additionally contribute into this region. And totally, this allows me, first of all, include this data in the analysis and improve precision of extracted PDFs at high X. And second, it allows to quantify impact of high twist turns or power corrections in general. Because otherwise, if you apply some ad hoc cuts on your data, you cannot be sure that you completely switched off impact of the power corrections, etc. As a valuable byproduct of this approach is that we just estimate power corrections, which are also very important, for fundamental problems of QCD.
Do you have something similar to the MRST conservative PDFs, where you just sort of keep cutting on X and Q squared to see how the agreement with remaining data changes?
No, I didn't perform these studies in details, but I can feel that inclusion of this region is important for constraints of PDFs. No, I understand. I just understood question as whether it would be meaningful to apply the same procedure here.
Right.
I didn't make detailed study, but I just tried to include this region or exclude it, and I feel that this is indeed useful for constraint of PDFs and so. Yeah, there is, of course, there is cut which removes resonance data. Resonance data. Yeah, the cut is about 2 GeV.
I mean, do you use the fit with the rest of the data to constrain these higher choice terms?
Yeah, and they are simultaneously instructed from the analysis.
Okay.
And in this sense, I automatically study impact of these higher choice terms on the PDFs and extract these PDFs from the data. And everything is performed in a consistent way.
Just a moment, maybe a little comment. The point is, you speak about dynamical higher choice. You should remind the neutron and the deuteron and the proton all have different dynamical higher choice operators. I mean, they are not universal in flavor, as we know, and there may be quark mass impact and so on. There's no consistent theory for this. But the point would be, if you really do it very refined, you have to fit 3 different higher twist terms.
This is exactly what I am doing.
You do that, yeah.
Okay. I also try to study either spin violation of higher twist terms as well. So we mentioned that I use deuteron data, and in order to prevent possible bias of the data or of the analysis, of course one has to take into account deuteron corrections, and these corrections are taken into account in the form of Fermi motion corrections. Quality of the fit is demonstrated in this plot. This is histogram of this ratio, data minus fit over error. And this histogram is compared to normal distribution. You see that the difference is invisible by eye. Nevertheless, it exists, but this is very small. And we can see that we have no spikes, no the shape, not only dispersion of this distribution coincides with normal distribution with unity, but we also have nice agreement of the shape of the distribution. So it allows to think that all data are internally consistent, and it allows to perform rigorous statistical analysis of confidence level, which comes from this study. And of course, for this analysis, I use delta chi-square equal to unity in order to estimate the level of the scale of errors, which these are not error bars. This is histogram of data minus fit over. This is just square root of number of entries in histogram. This is in some sense it looks like it's like experimental histogram. And I of course use rigorous treatment of probability theory when delta chi square equal to unity.
So just all your data points on this plot.
Sorry.
Yeah.
At the end of analysis, I extract from data fitted curve and divide by the total. Yeah, and total number of entries in histogram is about 2,000.
But this is not 2,000 error bars, I can see.
No,
yes, of course. Of course, number of entries in each bin is not 2,000. It's
the area under the curve is 2,000.
Yeah, and area is 2,000.
Okay. So I'm a little bit confused. Is this somehow a sign that all the errors in the data are statistically dominant? Otherwise, you'd expect the same deviations from Gaussian behavior because of system.
Yeah, of course I miss some details. In fact, you see that in this estimate I use covariance matrix, and before construction of this histogram, I have to diagonalize this covariance matrix, And after this, I obtain uncorrelated data set, and I can consider all.
In other words, the rank errors, currently these rank errors are already taken into account.
Yeah, they are taken into account, but. Let me proceed further. If we stop at this point, let me proceed further and show another slide. Let's concentrate on this part. I use this kind of estimator, which is chi-square with four correlated errors. And covariance matrix C is constructed in the following way, where measurements can be described as theory with fluctuations due to statistical uncorrelated errors and correlated and systematical or correlated errors. And so chi-square is of this shape. Anyhow, I can diagonalize this error matrix and reduce these differences to some another shape with a count of square root of C in the minus first power. And then what I plotted in this histogram is just these differences reduced to the uncorrelated case. Okay? So what are results? Of course, I skip many details and many maybe important points, but due to limit of time. I would like to start from the perturbative stability of PDFs. This is maybe most important for theorists. You see, since for deep and elastic scattering, we have calculated leading order corrections next to leading order and partially calculated next to leading order corrections, we can perform analysis for these three variants of approximations and compare PDFs obtained in each set in order to study perturbative stability of PDFs. We see that at existing level of experimental precision, the perturbative stability is relatively good. So the dots correspond to leading order, full curve correspond to next to leading order, and dashes to next to leading order. For most of pattern distributions given in this plot, for gluons, for C quarks, and for valence quark and isospin asymmetry, we observe for most kinematics relevant for real physics, real future studies at colliders, we observe more or less stable behavior with respect to next to leading order corrections. The only exclusion is region of small x for total strange, where the scale of variation due to NNLO corrections is larger than experimental errors. In other cases, all variations due to NNLO corrections are smaller than existing experimental errors in PDFs. This, of course, is promising because it means that we have hope that with calculation of even higher orders, we anyhow would obtain the same PDFs as we have now. Impact?
So, do you find the same overall quality of the fit in each order?
Yeah, it's approximately the same. Approximately the same.
What was the delta chi-square range that you show the error
bands? Everywhere, as I told before, everywhere I used delta chi-square equal to unity, as it is predicted, as it is necessary from the from probability theory. So, but anyhow, we know that we have no NNLO corrections completely calculated, and for this reason we have to study what is the impact of remaining uncertainties. Fortunately, remaining uncertainties are not so important. These are results of variant fits, one fit for, and this are NNLO variants of fit. This is for average, for some average value of splitting functions in NNLO corrections to the splitting functions, and one sigma again calculated with delta chi square equal to unity, 1 sigma for these PDFs. And dashes correspond to some variant, one variant of the of this kernel. We see that again the difference between central value and one of the variants of the evolution is within experimental errors in the PDFs. For us, a pattern distribution, it is even.
It looks different from the previous plot. In that one, the glue line looks better than the.
But this is
the stability.
Yeah, but these are different plots because that plot was the impact of if we apply average value for the NNLO kernel, and this is variation of some specific choice.
Somehow
for
the average, it looks like you got lucky with the gluon. Is that true that if you use a different value for the gluon?
Yeah. You mean to say that this stability may look as accidental, yeah?
Yeah.
So if you select variant B for evolution, you will get worse perturbative stability.
Yeah.
Just try. Yeah. This is right. Yeah.
The
scales.
The
scales. No, scales are the same. Q square is the same, and. Yeah, sure, because in this case, of course, I include.
Yeah,
I compare to leading order. Yeah, sure. So other theoretical errors were analyzed, and they were found not to be important. So also, see, these are theoretical errors due to variation of mass of sea quark by this quantity, and strange sea suppression factor by this quantity. This is a ratio of the theoretical error, which is caused by this. Variations to the experimental errors, and you see that for different pattern distributions, for gluons, C, up and down quarks, and you can see that in most cases these theoretical errors are comparable to the experimental errors.
You don't expect any sensitivity to different flavors, right? You just fit one process, so it's one particular combination of flavors.
No, I fit two processes. I fit scattering of proton and deuterons.
Right. So
this allows me to determine.
Sensitivity to strange.
No, of course I have no sensitivity to strange. I have to expect some sensitivity, and I take this quantity from the neutrino experiments. I wouldn't like to comment how precise are these determinations, and in order to allow. To understand the uncertainty which is caused by this approximation, I vary the suppression factor by this quantity which is also defined from neutrino experiments. But eventually, of course, I cannot separate from these studies as I cannot separate the flavors completely. I will try to comment about this later on.
What is that suppression factor?
0.42.
No, but what is it?
0.42.
Yes. No, what is it?
Oh.
Divided by the average of U and D, some Q square.
Okay.
Yeah, something like this. Yeah.
Then you vary it by 0.1.
Yeah. You can define it in different ways. You can define it as ratio of pattern distributions or ratio of the moments. It's not so important.
I'm concerned, John, coming back to the other part, there's the obvious question: Q square with V square, we have rarely some charm. Only developing, and only the higher bins one certainly would have a real charm excitation. Would this picture apply to the higher bins as well, similarly?
I'm not sure that existing data are so sensitive to charm contribution.
Yeah, 40% about 30%, 40% in the ERA data.
Yeah,
but the error.
And
no, it comes from the gluon. I mean, this is basically the question that we have a next living order coefficient function attached to the gluon. And this part, gluon is big, the flavor splitting function is also not very small. And there's a charm quark mass. I mean, one would like to know in the overall area what would change? This is the question you.
Yeah, for my understanding, existing data are not so precise in order to use this potential. I understand these arguments, okay. but I think
it's not so important.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
This is because he's not fitting F2 charm.
No, I'm just saying.
You can always trade off charm.
Yeah, but even if you include direct charm data into the analysis, I wouldn't expect much impact on the results of fit at the existing level of precision. It would be, I hope that it would be much more, they will be much more useful at the later stages when with upgrade of luminosity at here and so on. And so the in total.
You're looking just right at where the exhaust fan is, so that's what it's keeping
for. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. So we see that indeed, the hope that we can obtain a reliable set of PDFs from DIS data is more or less realized. And it's interesting to look how these PDFs can be used to predict cross sections for other processes. I calculated the rates of W and Z at Fermilab at this energy, and for calculation I used coefficient functions provided by Van Nieuwen and collaborators, and corrected by Kilgore and Harlander, and I used my PDFs in NNLO approximations and coefficient functions in NNLO approximation as well, accounted for all sources of errors which I described previously. Combined experimental errors and all theoretical errors, and obtained these error bands for the cross-section of Z and W at Fermilab energy. These predictions are compared to the recent measurements. The points are taken from the talks given at this conference. And we can see that, first of all, we have good agreement between experimental between predictions coming from, remind you that I don't use any data other than DIS. So in some sense, this is one of cross checks of universality of PDFs. And the second point is that the error band which is given by PDFs is not so large as compared to the experimental errors. So
in this case, you don't use any separation of D and S, but it doesn't matter.
What do you mean by separation D and S?
Well, with just DIS, you cannot separate the down and strange variable.
D bar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, but it
doesn't.
No, but it can separate. It can separate because we have NMC experiment. I have an NMC experiment in the analysis, and this is, of course, I cannot say that this difference. D bar and S bar, U bar is defined very well with very nice precision. But anyhow, I feel this difference, and I obtained some constraint on this.
So that's D minus U.
Yeah.
What about separating strange from down?
Oh no, I cannot. I cannot. I told.
Because you've got U on D bar.
Yeah. Yeah, well, right. It's the difference.
That's in the variable. So that's precisely what the W does care about.
Sorry.
The D bar.
And anyhow, the error due to S bar suppression is of course included into the total error bands, which is given for W and Z rates at this plot.
If you have to put this delta E to S equals 0.1, because if you didn't put that in, then you would have a much bigger variation of the W cross section, I believe.
I'm not sure. Why do you think so?
Well, there are various sources, possible sources for having larger errors. So you just pointed out one. And there's also the possibility of internal parameterization. If you use a more general functional form,
yes,
could result in change. And the reason he is having a very small error band compared to other work is, of course, here you stay strict to this criteria of the Dalek high square if you want. That's why the even if your constraining power of the data set is less, the nonetheless you get small errors because you insist on the elasticity of the warning.
So the CPAC values would be around 2.7 for the W cross section.
2.7.
So for the W cross section times branching ratio, I think the CTEC average is around 2.7.
I don't remember exactly.
T is probably around 2.65 or something like that.
I don't remember exact values. Okay, it can be read from the plot.
The right side of the error.
2.85 for W and 0.265, yeah, for Z.
MRST and NLO is 2.69.
You probably did not include this correction. Yeah?
Yeah. I think it's probably not too profitable for us to really start to compare numbers in terms of the purpose of this session, I think, is to point out the features of the different.
Yes, sure.
Comparing notes and so on should be left.
Yeah. But anyhow, I just wanted to demonstrate statistical power of obtained PDFs.
I'm just addressing to the questions.
Yeah. Thank you.
If we all lay inside that band, we could go home, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, and.
Are you going to talk about your parameterizations?
Not in details. So, since we have shootout, I would like to proceed to comparisons with other approaches, and thus emphasize particular features of my field. This is comparison of the precision of PDFs, which are obtained from my field and from the global field. I used for comparison parametrization CTEC 6. Full line corresponds to my PDFs, which remind I extracted from GIS data only, and dots correspond to CTEC parameterization, which is extracted from GIS data as well, data from other for other processes. This is relative accuracy of different pattern distributions. Gluon, some selected set for Q square equal to 9, for gluon, total C, D quarks and up quarks.
This is the
relative uncertainty in percent.
Relative to what?
To the central value. So this is delta G divided over G.
So this is, there's no statement here about how the central values compare. This is just a statement about how the errors.
Yeah, compare. How the errors are compared. Yeah, exactly. Because you see that very often you can say, you can listen that, you can hear that GIS data only are not so precise if you, PDFs extracted from GIS data only are not so precise. You have to add more process in order to improve determination of different pattern distribution in different specific regions and so on. So the goal of this comparison is try to understand what is the real power of one analysis, what is the real predictive power of one analysis and another one. And you can see that surprisingly, in most cases, the errors in pattern distributions extracted from the global field are larger than the errors extracted from the GIS data only. Probably the only example is strange C at relatively large X at X 0.2.3, which is evident impact of the Drell-Young data. However, of course, this comparison is not. Of course, this comparison is not so conclusive because everybody probably knows here that for estimating of errors, CTEC uses criterion delta chi square equal to 100, and I use criterion equal to unity. So, if we would like to improve, it's bigger. Yeah, if we would like to improve. To make this comparison more consistent, we would to apply reverse tolerance factor. So divide these errors by 10, which corresponds. Yeah. But just to understand how to compare things reasonably, consistently. We have to divide these errors by 10 and then compare with my determination once more. This is done.
No, I don't agree, because you cannot divide by 10. In our approach, if you divide by 10, it doesn't make any sense.
But this corresponds exactly to the case when delta chi square equal to unity, and yeah, which is well founded in the probabilistic theory.
Not at all, because we're talking about different views of the chi square function. So, no, we can discuss this later.
Yeah,
but
yeah, sure.
I just don't think you can directly compare the chi square.
Presumably, in the CTEC analysis, if you actually put in delta chi square equal 1, you discover that different bits were inconsistent.
That's right, exactly. And you did too. I'm going to show some of
it. No. I mean, okay. Just for clarification, I have a question. I mean, when I grew up with things, we used a different approach. We had a number of parameters to fit, say, maybe 20. And then the chi square was just described as the chi square distribution, so you have the so called up value which you have to add. Unless you fit more than one parameter, this up value is definitely larger than one. Now, it may be that you have a different definition on how you treat the errors, as we have shown us in the very beginning, though this may explain everything. But in our polarized analysis, for instance, we were going to the minute manual, to the up table, and had to add, say, for 8 parameters, maybe 8.5, or I don't know what. There's a certain value which we have to add. It's definitely not one. Now, let me understand. You do something totally different than we do?
I didn't go to details of your analysis, but I use a criterion which is widely published in a lot of textbooks, and I was not going to repeat this argumentation here, just because I thought that this is losing time.
Very different method.
Let me finish one sentence. from probabilistic theory, yeah, you have no other criterion other than delta chi square equal to unity.
Yeah.
Everything you use extra is extra of probabilistic theory.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm happy that you agree.
No, I don't disagree. It's just, I mean, I think your analysis is very interesting because it represents one approach where you state what your rules are and you stick to it, and you obtain these results. And there is a reason why this is different from what you hear from James. Well, he gave you actually at the conference a very good review, and I'll have some comments when my turn comes. But we're not comparing apple with apple, orange with orange, and I'll say why later. But
yeah.
I think your analysis as it stands is fine. It's I have nothing to criticize.
Yeah, but anyhow, I would like to proceed,
right.
Because it would be easy to discuss everything at the end of our talks, my talk and your talk, yeah, instead of starting discussion just in the middle of of the presentation.
Exactly. That's why
we'll do it that way. Let's do it that way.
Okay. So in fact, I try to compare apples with apples, and for this reason, I divided these errors by 10, in order to reduce this determination with the common statistical criteria. And I observed the second surprise. You see that in this case, the precision of PDFs, which is obtained from your analysis, using chi-square equal to unity, which is canonical choice, we obtain precision of different pattern distributions at very low level, or at very high level. Precision of pattern distribution is well in the region of small x, is well below unity, and in some cases this is just equal to 0.2, so which is just impossible. Because you see that we have no experiments which can constrain PDFs with such precision. See, it means that doing this way, in fact, you are trying to estimate sensitivity of different or combination of experiments to different PDFs, and you observe that sensitivity of different experiments to PDFs is at very high at very high level, which is impossible to understand, because I told that we have no experiments with precision of better than typically 2 or 3%, and it's unclear how can we constrain PDFs from these experiments with such good precision. In order to understand the reason of these two surprises, I can offer two variants of conclusion. The first conclusion is that addition of more data, this is very formal conclusion which just follows from comparison of the full curve, so without any recalculation of errors. So I just compare errors coming from in PDFs coming from DIS data, I compare errors coming from the global feed, and I find that addition, one variant of conclusion, that addition of more data is useless for improvement of PDF precisions. What is the reason? The argumentation is regularly given by Wookie in his talk, and probably he will repeat it now. I just briefly outline. So if you have incomparable experiments, you have to increase the errors of these experiments to introduce this scale factor. And so in total, impact of improvement in statistical significance of experiments is compensated by theoretical errors which are introduced in this comparison, that you have nothing as compared to the more clean determination in deep and elastic data. This is one variant of conclusion. Another variant of conclusion, which comes from comparison of these curves and these curves, is that errors in PDFs are just underestimated in the analysis, in the CPEC analysis.
Which errors do you mean? Which errors? The dotted lines or the dashed lines?
Dashed lines. So if I calculate sensitivity.
Those aren't their errors. They don't code those errors.
But if you reduce the error bands which are calculated with delta chi square equal to 100 to common determination, that is calculate sensitivity of data data to the PDFs, you will immediately find that you have very high sensitivity. So it looks like your data allows you to determine PDFs very precisely, but this is not the case. And the only conclusion which can come from this comparison is that the errors are just underestimated. If you use regular procedures, well defined procedure for calculating of errors using delta chi square. In order to clarify this point, I have to give some short tour to the statistics analysis, to the statistic analysis. You see that in all three variants of the fit, essentially chi-square estimator is used for estimating of pattern distributions. And this is the form of this chi-square estimator with covariance matrix given by this expression. And in the case of systematical errors or correlated errors taking place, it has this form with part which corresponds to uncorrelated errors and part which corresponds to correlated errors. What is the difficulty in we know very well that for many years different people use chi-square in the simplest form very easily and have no problem in estimating any significant levels and so on. The question is why do correlated errors introduce so much troubles? Huh? I'm not responsible for huge amount of questions which were given me at the talk. And then you encouraged me in the beginning that I can spread out as. So anyhow, I will try to speed up. but this part is necessary. What is the problem if you introduce correlated errors? The problem is that if you don't have correlated errors, then this matrix is just diagonal, and inversion of this matrix and all other operations with this estimator are very simple. If you introduce correlated errors, then you have And if, for example, these correlated errors are relatively large, then this matrix is very poorly determined. Determinant of this matrix is going to zero, and all operations with these expressions are getting very numerically unstable. I remind that these terms are calculated if you perform PDF fits. They are calculated as Diglab evolution. This is two-dimensional integral. It's very difficult to perform this integration with very precisely. And if you have this matrix with very small determinant convoluted with these differences, all these instabilities which arise in integration, they are amplified in this expression, and this makes the problem very difficult. What is the indicator which can understand this as quantitatively how difficult is this problem? These indicators can be constructed in different styles, in different ways. I use this dispersion of this ratio. This is difference between fitted value and measurements weighted with this total error. And dispersion of this quantity is good indicator of how large is correlation, how important is correlation in this task. If we have no correlations at all, then dispersion of this quantity is order of unity over n, so it's very small for large number of data sets, which means that in average data follows the fit more or less closely, and there is no indication, no deviations in general. If data are very strongly correlated, this dispersion of this quantity comes to unity, and we obtain the case when this matrix has very small determinant. How important is correlation for real experiments? This is the table for some selected set of real experiments which are used in the analysis. And we can see that this indicator, this is dispersion of that ratio, average ratio, this indicator with total errors taken into account is at the level of more than 0.5. And if you don't take into account normalization errors, it is significantly smaller. It means, in fact, that normalization errors gives you the main impact on the correlations when you try to perform analysis with account of correlated data. It's very easy to understand qualitatively, because you see that we know that first of all the scale of normalization error for most of experiments is the largest scale of all errors for I mean existing experiments is largest of the between all errors which are relevant for the measurements, and the second problem is that is that this error is perfectly correlated. So if we have normalization error for the experiments, it means that we have all data points correlated perfectly. So in practice, this means that first of all, if we don't take into account normalization error, as in the case of CTEC analysis, we of course the task. The minimization task is much simpler. I remind that the dependence of difficulty of the task is non-linear function of this delta r, because if you get this this value close to unity, then in this case your matrix just gets singular. So it means that the difference between two cases is very significant. First of all, it's very significant from the point of view of difficulty of task, and the second, it's very significant from the point of view of difference in the results. This is illustrated in this plot where I give the ratio of pure normalization error to other correlated errors for different pattern distributions in wide range of x, and you see that in most cases normalization error is at least of the same scale as all other correlated errors, and in many cases it is much more it is much larger than the error then the error than other errors. So trying, of course, to speed up and skipping some details, which maybe later will be used in discussion, I will try to give some outlook. Of course, comparison which I made cannot be considered as perfect. It's just sketch of the comparisons, just indication. In summary, of course, it looks that when you apply your tolerance factor, you just overestimate the scale of errors in artificial way, and you try to compensate some deficits of the analysis. So you have underestimated errors, and then you have to introduce some additional factor which gets errors to the reasonable level. And in some cases, we observe agreement between results. For example, that is what told in the talk of James. You see that. Say errors in due to pattern distribution estimated, say for Higgs cross section or for WZ cross section are comparable. They are at the level of 2-3%. But this is fake agreement. In fact, we have many details which disagree in the analysis, and we have to study these details. We have to study these disagreements in details. In fact, this work was initiated at the Lesouch workshop 2 years or even 3 years ago, but unfortunately was not accomplished. It was not continued. We had suggested some benchmark for testing different codes and comparison results in order to understand what is the real power of different code, how results can be compared, etc. And I hope that this workshop can reinitiate this activity. We can just start, because everything was prepared, in fact, at Lesouch, and we can just start from this point. Of course, this is just technical issue, and I hope that if participants of this process are active, we will be able to complete it in a couple of months or in several weeks. More difficult task, of course, is a real suppression of the errors in PDFs which we have to perform having in view future experiments in colliders. Of course, as I tried to explain in my talk, the main stream or in this direction would be clear understanding of all uncertainties, experimental uncertainties, and especially theoretical uncertainties for the process which are used to extraction of these PDFs. So if we indeed have such situation when we add more process which unclear theoretical uncertainties and don't improve precision of PDFs extracted from this analysis, so we just have not to use this additional data. And even if we indeed are going to improve precision of PDFs, we have to have clear understanding of theoretical uncertainties of different processes. In this respect, of course, the most promising improvement which can be made as compared to my analysis with good control of theoretical uncertainties, of course, the most useful real addition is addition of deep drill-young data in view of recent calculations of the NNLO corrections to this process and demonstration of relative perturbative stability of these corrections. JETS also would be useful, and it's interesting to add this to the data, but it seems that we do need NNLO corrections to this process before we can definitely quantify the uncertainties and not deteriorate precision of PDFs after addition of JET data. And ultimate goal of precise constraint of PDFs with separation of different flavors, which of course is missed in existing determinations. We can parameterize C suppression in this form or that form, but of course we miss many details. I think that this can be performed in some extent. It can be performed at LHC, but in most extent it can be performed in experiments with neutrino factory. I would return to the beginning of my talk and to speak once more again, to tell once more again about universality of PDFs. Of course, when we study effects of new physics, say at LHC collider, of course it would be very useful, it would be just nice to have PDFs extracted from other completely different process. Because in this case you have no impact on any imagine, for example, that you manage to feed your data using Fermilab data, yeah, and you have indeed some new physics in Fermilab deviations from predictions in standard model. Then if you feed your data to this, if you feed your PDFs to this data and later use these PDFs for analyzing effects of new physics at LHC, of course some of these new effects which will be hidden in your PDFs and statistical significance of your comparisons will be decreased. Yeah, it would be nice to have absolutely independent source of PDFs with very good precision. And I think that neutrino experiments with very high intensity and with good separation of flavors with large number of independent constraints on PDFs can solve this problem ultimately with precision of at the level of several percent. So, thank you.
Here, why don't we hold the question, then, Lucy, why don't you... By the way, is there anyone who's going to go to the colloquium? Sure.
What is the colloquium about?
I've told you many times I have no prepared talks. I mean, it's just off the cuff remarks.
Well, you can have an off the cuff discussion for an hour, I'm sure, if you want.
Well, I mean, it depends on who is willing to discuss. So I put together just we don't need the.
No problem. It's necessary.
It's better off the record.
if you want to speak off the record, it's okay. No, it's just the chance.
So, Wookie, would you need it?
I guess you could. Yeah, it's being filmed.
So being filmed also. Oh my God.
Whatever you say.
Dave, you got the.
You and your great grandchildren can look it up.
I should have made all those remarks.
Now, Tzvi only sent me an email last Thursday or Friday to say that you are expected to give whatever number. And I said, no way, I have no time. So what I did is that after I arrived here, before I came here, I listened to the talk that James gave last week. And I thought that was a very good survey of the field. And basically, I'm going to assume that everybody not only heard James, but understood and remembered everything that he said. So I'm just going to make some remark to supplement what he said. And then it turns out the few thoughts which came to me that I put together are rather complementary, I think, to the previous talk. So in that sense, it's good. So right off the cuff, let me assure you one thing. That is, let me first make one statement. Of the people who have invested real time to study the extraction of a nucleon structure from doing global QCD analysis, I think roughly, you can say there are two different approaches. One is
the two efforts which are similar are the one described by Sergey and one that has been advocated by Walter Gille and Dave Kalsauer and Keller. They insisted on statistical rigor in terms of following established statistical procedures.
Actually, one practical point. You have a countdown clock behind you looking.
No signal. Oh, okay.
You open your laptop if the projector's going to shut down.
Okay. The the other approach is the line that which has been followed by, why is it not coming on? Oh. Huh. Okay, let's cancel this one. And is there a PowerPoint here? No PowerPoint. Here. Santa Barbara, PowerPoint, okay, F5, right? Okay, so the other approach is that followed by MRS group and the CTAC group, where the priority is put on using all available data from all available processes. Which make the input data a more comprehensive set, a more complicated, and the idea there is then you get the full constraining power of different processes. Therefore, you can differentiate between different flavors, and so on. It turns out, as for reasons that I will mention. You will find that then you are dealing with a rather different task, and you have to make different choices, and you have to make different compromises, and that's what we need to discuss. I want to assure you, even if, as the previous speaker has already indicated, we take great liberties with the interpretation of chi-square and so on, that we do read books on statistics, and we do, I think, understand statistics, and we understand the likelihood approach, for instance, that that the GKK collaboration emphasizes, being more general and all that, and. In the chi-square approximation, delta chi-square, the meaning of delta chi-square equal to 1 and all that, we do understand. But it's a matter, when we study nature, we always have to make choices. We don't have to always make approximations. So we're basically talking about different perspectives, different hard choices we have to make. So what are these hard choices? The few transparencies I threw together sort of try to just give you an idea. Now, as you know, the in the last few years, the most effort has been concentrated on trying to pin down these uncertainties of the pattern distributions. We've been working with the best fit pattern distributions for many, many years. And just how good are they? So you need to know these uncertainties. And we think we've made a lot of progress with the four different groups looking at the problem for the past 4 or 5 years or so. The one message I want to make is that the statistical methods, whether it's the likelihood approach or the chi-square approach and so on, are really textbook stuff. We all agree, we all agree to the extent possible that we need to adhere to those things. The trouble, however, is not only the detail, is not the devil is not just in the details, just carrying them out. I mean, understandably, it's a tedious process to carry out this global analysis, but it's not just in the details. The problem which stands in our way, as we see it, are really there are these intangibles, things which are not under our control. You see, the techniques are under our control. The mathematics, the programming, the CPU time, those are under our control. What's not under our control are the unknown theoretical uncertainties and also imperfect experiments. No experiment is perfect. We know that. If all experiments were behave exactly the way the textbook say they should, then we all go home. We just use the GKK likelihood method. We use the chi-square method of Sergey, and you know, then it's just a matter of manpower, and we just grind through. But that's really not the problem. That unfortunately. So I think to focus on, you know, whether your method is right, is the better one, or my method is better one, is really barking at the wrong tree, because that's not what the problem is. To illustrate this, let's ask, oh heck, this is my remote. This is, I'm quoting from the GKK study, which uses, as I said, the likelihood method. And in principle, it actually is quite similar to what Sergey has been using, you know, using it, as I understand it, you are, correct me if I'm saying anything wrong, that, you know, you include the whole full correlated systematic errors and so on, and you evaluate the likelihood of, in this case, five different analyses emphasizing each particular experiment with a certain way of parametrizing the input pattern distributions, which represents unknown. We don't know how nature parametrizes. So they use the MRST parametrization. And here are the likelihood that if you use the H1 experiment as the input, then how, and get your set of Parkin distribution, how likely are the other sets of experiments? Here, right away, you can see Joyce is a set of experiments which is done exactly at Hera, very, very similar, and the probability comes out to be 0.5%. The NMC, a very, very accurate experiment done at fixed target. And in fact, if you look at the line under NMC, all the probabilities are very small, indicating, if you believe in this result, indicating that this experiment somehow stands out and it doesn't quite agree with the other experiments. And you know, you can read the various columns that right away it tells you that there are the task is not as simple as you'd like to. Just a moment. Just a moment. Of course, I know this. I know that this seems to be in disagreement with what Sergey was telling us, because he was saying that
this is not compatibility of experiments. This is compatibility of experiments to the MRST cell.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. Okay. Fine.
This is not compatibility of experiments between themselves. This is just quality of MRST parameterization.
Fine. So that also highlights one thing, that parameterization is important, which is not quantified. You know, that there are various things. So I emphasized the word unknown in the previous transparency. There are a lot of factors which are unknown, which are not totally under control, which that's the reason we have a workshop here, all right? I mean, we can probably talk and benefit from pin down some of these things, but there are these intangible problems.
Okay, could you remind us, please, what was the MRST distribution you compared
with? No, not the distribution. It's just the way they parameterized the initial distribution.
I know that, but yeah. They have done many, many fits. So which MRST was it?
No. It's not using MRST fit at all. This is the Gila fit. This is a Gila fit using the parameterization. Yeah.
What is the last column? I just usually didn't quite read it.
Oh, lap, that just means using the alpha S value from lap, I think. But the detail doesn't matter. I just want to give you the idea. So, similarly, you can look at, so here's a situation which is not just, this is a figurative example. But it, nonetheless, it's not all that unreal. But it just illustrates the problem. You know, and also this kind of problem is not only in global QCD analysis. The PDG group at Berkeley deal with this problem all the time, all right? Because experiments do disagree. And so here's an example. Suppose you have two measurements, and these are the errors, and they measured several times, or whatever, and you come out with results like this. They clearly don't agree. And if you know this experiment is wrong, then you throw it out. If you know this experiment is wrong, you throw it out. And suppose you don't know which experiment is, you have no reason to suspect one experiment is better than the other. Then what we are confronted with is a real world where this is the best information you have about this quantity, call it theta. Saying it's still up, you know, as physicists, we still have to exercise a judgment in terms of, you know, what is the best value for theta, given this is all the information you have. And that is a kind of problem that when we deal with large sets of data, we often find ourselves having to deal with. So, this is, I don't know how to kill it.
Click
Wait. Don't
ask me again.
Oh, that's right. Thank you.
Maybe you didn't pay your wireless bill.
Don't ask me again. And then cancel, huh? All right. So here's, so whether it's you're using chi-square, using likelihood, let's say the inverse of likelihood, this is a situation you encounter. And what do we do? And that is basically, I think, what we are, in this case, you know, what does confidence levels mean? What does likelihood mean? What does chi-square mean? This changes the rules of the game, if this is the input you have for your statistical analysis. Yeah, of course, if you don't encounter this situation, it's fine. I think Sergey is claiming that when he confines himself to the charged current scattering process, he can make things consistent. Then he doesn't have this problem. But we do find that we have this problem. That's and the GKK seems to also find this problem. And now, if you have this situation, it's a clear indication that you cannot take the, you know, as theorists, we used to, we'd have, be happy if we just leave all the experimental problems to experimentalists. We just take their results at its face value and play with it. But however, when they have problems as it's this kind, clearly, you know, that not everything is understood in, you know, one or both of these experiments. And that is nothing unusual, right? Our experimental colleagues work as hard as they can and take into account everything that they can think of, but there's still things they can't think of, just like theorists. The theory is imperfect as we stand. In fact, one of the reasons I would think, you know, it's necessary to go beyond what Sergey has described, even is because we largely have not addressed the uncertainties due to theory yet. And that will throw things off also. Anyway, so to continue to quote GKK, when you propagate that kind of situation into the actual physics analysis, for instance, the determination of alpha S, you encounter situations like this where they have 10 different scenarios, and depending on which experimental input you put in, because they are not all mutually compatible. So if you concentrate on the central value of the fit, you see that they vary from 0.108 to 0.12 or something like that. But then you look at the estimated uncertainty in any particular analysis, these are follow from rigorous statistical analysis, then these errors, in fact, turn, if you just look at all, I just highlighted one of them, if you look at all of them, they are typically much smaller than the spread of the central value. So in that case, what does this statistically rigorous result you get, what does it mean?
Yes, but this is really due not to the experiment. This is just because we do not include proper theory. I think it's not included. So these dimensions
are because self-fair determination for a very sensitive to try to use the car. And it can be interpreted both as some problems which you are describing and, and two, due to some lack in theory.
It's the lack of theory that usually causes this.
This conclusion from this comparison is unclear.
Yeah, well, I'm not clarifying anything. I'm throwing out the problems on the table, okay? That's why I'm not here to argue. I just want to show. So here is their analysis of the W prediction for W cross-section propagating the errors from this analysis and the Z cross-section. So you have similar situations. I don't want to repeat myself. So here, again, you have your central values, which spread by about that order of magnitude. And if you look at the individual errors from each analysis, well, it goes off the screen, but it's much smaller. It's about 0.1 or so. So we just to show you that we encounter the same kind of problem when we use our less rigorous but more inclusive kind of analysis. This is the CTEC study of the W, the first study of the W cross-section using the chi-square method. And using a Lagrange multiplier approach, we can map out our global chi-square, which we simply use as a measure of the goodness of a fit, as a function of the sigma W. And you can see that you have a minimum value, and then when you go either side of that, your chi-square increases. So how far do you go? This is the famous 100 one, which has been under attack ever since the first day it was proposed. But the way you can look a little bit deeper into that is to look at the individual experiments and ask for the same, the chi-square for each individual experiment, around the value of your global minimum, you know, how does things behave? You see, there are experiments which doesn't care at all, which is insensitive to the W, and there are those which seem to have reasonable behavior. And then you have experiments which bound the value from above, and those which bound it from below. And the way we arrived any guess of what the range might be. I forgot what's the word that James used in terms of the way we pick these values are fairly subjective, but we try to use some basically common sense judgments. For instance, if we take these different experiments and in fact apply a quote unquote delta chi-square equal to 1 criteria. Again, even the delta chi-square equal to 1 in this case does not carry the same meaning as the kind of chi-square that Sergei mentioned. So I'm not going to try to defend it, all right?
Excuse me, for my understanding, you don't apply Deuteron corrections for analyzing the Deuteron.
That's right, that's right. That's
so this might be the reason for the Deuteron. Yeah,
that's right, that's right.
And in addition, there are some, we know very well that there are some methodical problems in the CCFR neutrino experiment.
That's right.
They can be described not to statistical procedure itself, but just to problem of experiments, which are more or less known. And if we drop out these two points, we can see that all other points are more or less comparable.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to argue the detailed points because we don't have the time, and I don't think everybody is interested in the details. Yes, I do not disagree. I mean, I have my own interpretation of why we differ, and we'll discuss that in due time. All right. The point is these possible differences, possible incompatibilities. There are indications of these possible incompatibilities, but you know we can argue about a particular case, and that is, as I said, we can do it at another forum. What we did use, what we thought was a compromise, was to say what we did, I have to go back and mention one thing. That is, even when you do global analysis like this, I have only talked about the possible incompatibility between experiments, but there is something even, which is even more bothersome, which the way which actually can cause the same amount of grief, is that when you look at, let's say, 15 different experiments here, and you ask what is the chi-square per data point for each of these different experiments, even if you fit it to the best of your abilities, and they vary widely. Maybe, you know, a third of the experiments have the chi-square, minimum chi-square value be roughly 1 per data point. And there are well-known data sets which the chi-square per data point is like 1.7, 1.5, and so on for an experiment which has 100 data points, 300 data points, and so on. When that happens, of course, you know something is wrong even before you start. All right? Therefore, but in the spirit of this kind of global analysis where we do make compromises, therefore, what the procedure we've used, in fact, when we make this plot here, is that we then normalize the chi-squares for those experiments which has abnormally high chi-squared, as well as those who have abnormally low chi-squared. There are experiments which has very low chi-squared, you know, very improbable low chi-squares as well. Using normalized or rescaled chi-squares, as far as I know, don't have any real rigorous theoretical foundation as well. But it's widely used in the experimental world because, again, it's not an uncommon occurrence. And this is how things look once we rescale the chi-square and then draw a band for each one of them with a 90% confidence level integrating over the distributions. And with this, then, of course, things look much better. And then, basically by eye, we would say that a reasonable range of chi-square for the cross-section would be lie within this band. I mean, that's you know, whether it's this much higher or this much lower is anybody's guess. I think here basically I would use the same words that James had used in terms of what you can do with it. So to summarize, basically the situation is this. We see there are three different scenarios under which you need, we confront the real world, where we need to do something about estimating the uncertainties. The simplest possible case is like this, and if we can bring everything into agreement like this, then the errors in this case would be dominated. So again, suppose you have two different experiments there. Then the error would be dominated by the true errors. And then when you have widely apart, oh, this is, I don't know if this wide is still off the screen. If this is so much bigger than this, then basically you have, but strictly speaking, you have incompatible experiments. And you either then throw both of them out, or what else you do?
If we, why don't you throw both of them?
Well, but in that, well, you can do that. Then basically, you will be throwing away, let's say, all Drell-Yan data out, or all JET data out, or all.
But Drell-Yan is again what it already defined, right?
No.
There are measurements in Drell-Yan and there are other measurements in
Drell-Yan. No. Depending on your aim.
You just want to throw out.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some theoretical higher order.
That's right.
Big in one case and big in the
other.
Yeah. No, you see, to throw out an experiment, you have to have a reason for it, right? And because that's part of the reality we are facing. That's our philosophy, is that without having a good reason, this is just as valid a piece of information as the ones you keep.
Well, here's two scientific reasons. One is the intrinsic chi-squared, which you already mentioned, and another one is compatibility with another set, you know,
right,
processes. So you could play those games more,
yeah,
I guess, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we heard from James of these small x, small q-squared version, but there must be a ton of other things that could be done to try to analyze where the problems are coming from.
Sure. That is why I think what Sergey does is valuable. That's what I think we do. It also has a point, and we also need to talk to each other so that we can.
If this is possible, I just very short comment. I just would like to make a very short comment. From point of view of theorist or scientist or anybody else, it, in some cases, it's much more interesting to study discrepancies between this experiment rather than trying to combine them.
If you
artificially increase chi-square value, you just miss some information.
Yes,
these are completely different experiments. One is the Hadron Collider, one is the Lepton Collider.
Yeah.
Not in the same experiment.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
They're different axes, I think, is one of the things that James is saying, is that one of them is bringing one piece of information, imperfect information, the other one is bringing another slice. It's on a different axis. Mm-hmm. As well, right?
But there should be cases where, you know, we can judge.
Experiments have been thrown out if we knew a reason. There's an old EMC experiment. I don't know if you are old enough to know. EMC experiment is not inconsistent with other experiments, but later we know it's wrong, so it's thrown out. It's replaced by the NMC experiment. Yeah, there are photon experiments we have thrown out. Well, that's because of theoretical uncertainties. We really don't know what to do. Yeah. That's right. We've thrown out Drell-Yan experiments, E772, even if it's the latest among that series, because, you know, the data doesn't make sense. It's self-contradictory in some way. So, yeah, sure. I mean, we have to use judgment. That is the bottom line. We can't just throw things out and say, I just want to deal with statistical, like, you know, our purpose is not to do statistically consistent exercise. Our purpose is to figure out what nature is. That's.
You get reaction back from the experiment.
Sorry?
There is any reaction back from the experiment.
Sure. We put people have spent decades of their life measuring prompt photon experiments.
Yes.
And then you tell them, all that data is gone from the fifth.
Yes.
Sometimes take an effort to analyze
it. Well, the EMC people years ago found that they had just screwed up in measuring the magnetic field or something.
Yeah.
So it went on. They admitted it was wrong. And BCDMS was wrong.
The photon interference.
I mean, I spent decades of my life, you know, measuring prompt photon, and I threw it out. Because I know the theory, you know, is.
Well, also experimentally, you have this basic difference between E706 and WA70, right? I mean, neither side wants to give ground, and the rest of us cannot really say one is right or the other is wrong, you know, definitively.
You can take my word for it.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, I mean, anyway, so what I'm saying is that the kind of prescription we have been using amounts to, you know, the kind of situation like an ambiguous situation, then you have to sort of find some compromise, some prescription which involve both this divergence in central value as well as the individual uncertainties. I certainly cannot prove that what we do have, you know, any fundamental justification, but we all have to use our judgments. That's my only defense, and that's the source of this tolerance, which you know, we guessed 100. I mean, I don't have to swear by it. You know, if they guessed 50, I can take 50 also fine. You know, I mean, it's you say, then what's its meaning? What is this one standard deviation or whatever? I say, sorry, I don't know. All right, this is some, because if it's possible to define an ambiguous one standard deviation, I would have done it. And I also tell you that I do know how to read textbooks, but that doesn't help me when I'm dealing with this global analysis system, which is
we all do. I mean, we theorists make predictions for cross sections, and they vary the scale between half ET and 2 ET, right? And they present a band.
Yeah.
In your paper, right? That's not plus or minus.
Yeah.
Guess.
And I don't feel much bad about this either. Ask our esteemed experimental colleagues. There are at least two here, right? How do you determine your hard-to-crack systematic errors? You know, you have a list of 10 systematic errors. You do everything you possibly can to understand those 10 systematic errors. 5 of them, maybe you feel confident you can quantify them. Maybe there are 2 or 3, 4 left, which is very hard to crack. You do model studies, you do one scenario, the other thing. Eventually, you sit, a committee sits down. That's the way I picture it anyway. A smoke-filled room. You try to do some hard bargaining. What is, you know, it is really is. And then you go by your guts, don't you?
That's the nature of systematic errors. I mean, statistical errors, we have all understood that only for
exactly.
Those errors, the interpretation of plus minus one standard deviation in terms of chi-square is 1 to 1. As soon as you have systematic uncertainties,
that's right.
Which you don't know what they are.
Exactly.
Because systematic uncertainties are those that if you would know what they are,
then you would have corrected for it.
Correct for
exactly.
And then they would be 0. So
yes.
There are all kinds of these errors which
yes.
you would,
yeah.
if you would know their real origin,
yes.
you would be able to really wipe them out, to
yes.
correct for them. These are systematic uncertainties. They do not apply
yeah.
to this delta chi square equals such and such sigma.
Exactly.
Simply not possible.
Exactly.
So any kind of systematic uncertainty is or error. I call them uncertainties. They are not
yeah.
errors.
That's right.
Any kind of systematic uncertainty is
yeah.
completely up to your educated yeah. guess.
Exactly.
And whoever wants afterwards to interpret delta chi squares in terms of so and so probabilities is entirely wrong. You cannot do that.
No. I'm glad I heard that from you, because
you can make an estimated guess and you can say for your own one experiment that
that's right.
I studied 3 different Monte Carlos and it looks nice and I have a small system on here. So 5 years later somebody comes with a new Monte Carlo and
yes.
has a much bigger answer. Here.
That's exactly, that's why I think theorists cannot, that's right.
In terms of probability.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
They're not Gaussian distributed.
They are not Gaussian.
Well, that part is okay because I've heard this. Yeah. That's right.
What is the only procedure? At least the
I have the same problem with calculating the alpha as well, the world alpha SFP. Actually, the central value is easy, but the error, what is
yeah.
the error?
Yeah.
The electrolytic field has the same rule.
Yeah. Anyhow, first of all, in order to document your opinion about systematic errors, I would like to say that there is a very well-known Bayesian approach for treatment of systematic errors. And within this approach, all errors, including systematic, are considered within statistical approach, and this approach is demonstrated to be successful.
Yeah, within one experiment, you may be, but with 15 different experiments, you have different definitions of the system.
Moreover, if you don't apply probabilistic treatment of systematic errors, you just have nothing to do with this huge amount of variation. Otherwise, if you don't need statistical treatment of systematic errors, you have to deal with, I don't know, 50 or 70 or 100 parameters, additional parameters, which correspond to your
model. Anyway, so that's my take.
You know, it's more or less productive way to handle with this huge amount of information. I also don't know. So
I think it's nice if different sets of people do different kinds of approaches
But the time is up, so I'm not dealing with the bother with the rest. I actually have other points, but I don't know, when do you want to...
Well, we can meet on Thursday.
Yeah, there are, I know James has a list of things which can be discussed. Oh, there are places where we need to agree to disagree, right? Because you've witnessed. that's fine. it's good to be rigorous. Nobody disputes that. It's good to be rigorous, but also, you know, the world we live in is not perfect. I mean, we also have to be reconciled to that fact. I mean, you look left, you look right, you know the world is not perfect. And the other point I want to make here is that when we can forge consensus, you know, when we do have a choice, for instance, there are ambiguities due to choice of schemes and things like that, where it would be easier to compare results if we make, you know, same choices, and so rather than just insist on different ways. But we shouldn't, of course, collude, you know, to all do the same thing. Therefore, whenever there is a distinctiveness, we also, it's correct for Sergei to emphasize his distinctiveness. And we should do the same so that we can expose all the possible weaknesses. Hopefully, in these workshops, we can bridge some, you know, do some of the compromising and compare notes.
I think it would be useful to, I mean, that benchmark study was at least 2001, was there specifically, you know, to have a bare bones type of comparison, mm-hmm. with sort of uncontroversial mm-hmm. experiments.
Yeah.
But
so I'm not going to talk about the other issue.
That would be nice to carry it out.
Yeah. It's probably wise for me not to talk about the other issues, but I just flash through them to see what I jotted down. James mentioned the tension between different physical processes, for instance, DIS and jets and so on. There are also tension between different experiments is pretty much we've talked about already. So. But the point is not necessarily, for instance, the slide I showed from the GKK thing indicates there's certain tension between these experiments. And we haven't talked about CCFR experiment. There's actually a can of worm there, which I don't know if we want to talk about for the rest of this workshop. Probably less known to this audience is even if you take one set of data, CDF and D0, there are, you know, they ask for certain common tendencies in terms of large X gluon, but there are some subtle tensions between them as well. I have some examples there. I'm not going to explain here. And then in their inter-processes, this is the one, you know, the MRS papers, I think, have explored some of those. Whether they are real or they are not, so on, of course, needs more exploratory work. So this is my slide on the jet about. So, anyone interested, we can talk about that later. What are the possible ways to resolve some of these problems? I just mentioned that Collins and Pumplin has been doing a study on and off for them. For quite a while now, where they use the chi-square approach, but they dig much deeper. They use both the hypothesis testing criteria, the well-known criteria, and the parameter fitting criteria, go back and forth, using to test the compatibility or to quantify the compatibility of different experiments. They use the method, the Lagrange multiplier, using weights. So these are some of the results. And the lessons they learned are not too surprising, but I think it's an interesting set of tools that they've set up. The other thing I was going to mention is that taking a Hessian approach, which is a classic approach which is used by everybody, I mean Minui program, which everybody uses, is based on that. But nonetheless, at least in our CTEC and certainly studies, we found that we have been stuck with this standard approach, not being able to really get reliable quantified results on uncertainties for a very, very long time until John Pumplin devised a rather critical technical advance using an iterative method, which I was trying to illustrate here, but I'll bypass that too. So in the end, I just listed sort of the set of agenda that we have set for ourselves for the near future, what to do. We have a project studying the details of the large X behavior of gluon UND, which is led by Steve Kuhlman, which is almost near the finishing stage. And we have done ongoing work on the studying the flavor structure of the nucleon, pinning down the strangeness sector, which is the one which have the most impact on the NUTEF anomaly application, which if we have time in this workshop, I have offered to give a presentation on that. And then, of course, down the line, we need to understand the CHOM content more. As far as collider, you know, the collider are somewhat like WZ factories. Therefore, you can do, there are a lot of mundane as well as exciting precision WZ studies one can do. It's a two-way street between predictions to what's going to be measured as well as feedback to global analysis from new measurements. And this new area of transverse momentum, detailed study of transverse momentum distribution, including resummation, clearly is a new area for global analysis. And it's eventually holy grail is to get a real grips on the uncertainty of the W mass measurement. Some of these require next leading order analysis, especially when you go down to the using WZ processes as luminosity standards or other precision goals. And then the final item, of course, is Higgs top and beyond standard model phenomenology. So we'll be busy, as everybody else will, I'm sure. Okay.
Show a few slides on yours,
just because
my laptop.
Oh yeah. In that case, let me plug the battery in because the battery may be running out at any time.
Maybe this one will work.
No, but this is fine.
I just wanted to say, maybe take 10 or 15 minutes and then put on the.
That's going to be the new sort of standard, is that people are just going to walk around with little memory sticks and just say, allow me to show a few trend policies.
So why does the signal still on? the latex improvements. I think that the latex, you have a soft condition.
Yes.
You perform with some interconnection which should be taken into account.
Depending on, you're talking about more like threshold effects, right? So you're producing a very large object, then you would that be true. In fact, yeah, for jet, I mean, corrections of that sort for jet cross-entering have been studied, right, by and for Zhao Yan, certainly, Sturman and others also. The effects have never been very large.
I mean, the black evolution. For the small parametrics, I think it's to be, it's to use a proper value.
It's W squared, as Brodsky would say.
But phenomenology certainly have not gotten to that stage where
yes, if you want to improve it, you said you want to study.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Large X.
Well, large X still is not all that large.
Right. It's 0.3.
No, not really. But there's something which needs to be kept in mind.
Okay, I just wanted to say a few words and then maybe wrap up the discussion for today. I won't talk about the business about the uncertainties because that's been already talked about a lot this afternoon. And as Wiki said, the MRST approach is very similar to the CTEC approach, and the delta chi squared at 50 versus 100 is just a choice. I wanted to focus on the fact that what happens when, and it's really a top-down approach where top means experimentalists. What happens when, at the end of the day, and I'll show you an example, you compare MRST with Aliakin and CTEC, and each is at their uncertainty bands, but the bands differ. Right? They don't overlap. What's going on? The reason is, of course, that the best fits are, you know, the central value of the bands are different. And I tried to list on one slide reasons why that might be, and I want to focus on that. I don't have answers, but I'll show you one or two examples of why you get out different distributions and different fits. And it's all to do with the assumptions that you make in setting up the fit. Right? The obvious one we've heard about today, if you put different data in the fit, you will get different PDFs. If you leave out the jet data in the fit, you will get a different gluon. You will also get different quarks. The different sub-selection of data, you take the H1 and Zeus data, you've got to put cuts on Q squared and W squared, maybe, if you wish, depending on what Q squared W squared cuts you put on, you'll get different PDFs. On the theoretical side, there are a lot of little things that make a difference. And if we want to define a theoretical uncertainty on PDFs, then we've got to take into account all of these things. Some of them Sergei has mentioned, but not all. We all fit in DIS, we set mu equals Q. Well, why not, right? Why don't we do mu equals half Q, mu equals 2Q, and then get PDFs out, different ones, and assign some sort of error to that. We should and we don't. When we fit to jet data, mu equals a half ET, 2ET, all that kind of stuff. So there are various choices about scales that affect the PDFs. Our value of Q naught squared, you say, well, that shouldn't matter. Q naught is just the scale at which you start everything. It makes a difference. MRST, CTEC use different Q naught. That is responsible for a small but noticeable difference in the distributions. What parametric form? Some people, you know, if you compare two sets, you'll see wiggles in the ratio. That's because different parametric forms. It's not physical. The different definition of alpha S. Do you use the lambda? Do you use this other implicit definition of alpha S? Whatever. The treatment of heavy flavors, that's by now understood. It used to be an issue. It's not anymore. You have fixed flavor scheme, variable flavor schemes. Within variable flavor schemes, you've got various choices. Whatever choice you use, you'll get a different PDF. The Zeus and H1 gluons are different, or they were a few years ago. They're very different at SmallX because one was using a variable flavor scheme, the other was using a fixed flavor scheme. Of course the gluons were different because they're different gluons. They're different objects. Theoretical assumptions about x goes to 0 or 1. We all use 1 minus x to the n,
right? We don't tolerate something which had a big spike near x equals 1 because we don't think it's theoretically reasonable. We assume small, smooth behavior at large x. We assume similarly smooth behavior at small x, maybe x to some power. Whatever you assume will take you out. Of course, these assumptions matter because the data stop at some outside some range of x, and whatever you assume for what happens outside there, outside that range can affect what you find inside the range. The C flavor symmetry has been already talked about. And then at the very bottom, the one that I've called removable differences. Of course, if there's a bug in my evolution program, then I'm going to get a different set of PDFs. There's nothing physical about that. That's
there
just.
There can also be different ways of treating higher order terms.
Yes.
Like in the alpha S discussion, I guess.
Yes. Of course, so yes, that's true.
Between the Mellin-Morgan programs and the
yes.
programs quite rigorously, so.
Okay.
But then one can measure, I think.
Let me show you. There's a nice study came out of Les Ouches, I think, by Juadi and Farag, and this is just an example of what the end user might see, right? And what the end user might work, might think, what the hell's going on? So this is Juadi and Farag calculating Higgs cross-sections at the Tevatron and the LHC and gluon fusion, right? And they took off-the-shelf MRST, CTEC, Alikin, with the errors. And they computed GG goes to H in the two cases, and there, well, okay, you stand far enough back, so that's great, they're all the same. It's good, especially at the LHC, it's even better. But then then they sort of blow up the difference, and then you begin to see what I mentioned. Actually, for the Tevatron, it's not too bad. If you look there, you sort of see, well, they're all sort of the same. They're all within plus or minus 10%, and even at some level, the bands overlap. So we could, I think, there maybe, draw an envelope and be finished and quit, right?
There is no...
But
different X masses in the two pairs.
I don't know. Yeah, possibly. I don't know what the Higgs mass is. Yeah.
Maybe you have 100,000, maybe you have only
100,000. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay. Right. But the point I wanted to make was here's between. Oh, here, yeah. If they then plot the ratio, you see the fact that the MRST gluon has a different shape in this relevant X region. You find that at small enough Higgs mass, the MRST band would be outside the Alyukin band and would begin to wander outside the CTEC band, whereas at high, heavy masses, the MRST band is sort of within the CTEC band, but it's at the upper side. Okay. So what I'm really interested in is why, what is going on here with these central... values. That's not a very good. I mean, there are other examples. Here's one. Here's another figure from these guys, which is the what is this? This is the WW fusion at the LHC, and now look what happens because the Alyukin band is way outside the other two and some 15% offset from it. So what are we to make of that? What are you to make of that? Right? Is it because there is, in fact, a theoretical error? As Sergey said, there are theoretical uncertainties. Is there a bigger theoretical uncertainty that would expand all of these bands so that they became compatible? Or are what MRST and CTEC doing just wrong and that this is the true uncertainty? But again, my approach in this case is to say, why is that distribution up there and why are these ones down there? Again, over here at the Tevatron, no, this is HTT at LHC. Well, the bands are kind of almost overlapping. It's not a problem. Now, of course, what happens, you see, what you're supposed to do, and Juadi and friend knew this, of course, all of this can be understood by making this plot. You can understand everything on those previous two slides by going back to this plot and comparing what the partons are doing. And you can just jump between them and understand everything. So these are now not bands anymore. These are the differences of the central, the best fits in each case. And you see a load of interesting stuff. There are about 20 different things to say about this plot. You can pick off each distribution and say something about it. I'll just give you, let's look at this one first. MRST gluon is smaller than the CTEC gluon. that's small x, right? It's pretty similar at large x, although that gives it a wrong impression. It's pretty similar in the region because they both fit the Tevatron data at some level. And there's a broad range of x between about 10 to the minus 3 and 10 to the minus, well, up to near 1, where the valence quarks are very similar, only differing by percent or two. The minority distributions are that high x is C quarks, they're a bit funny, but that's more or less irrelevant to anything you would ever want to measure. Okay, so the main difference here is the difference in the glue at small x, which drives, that's the difference in the quarks, but the two things are correlated very much. Now, comparing Sergei's with CTEC, you see, again, a much bigger difference in the glue at large x, because one fit has got jet data in and the other one doesn't, and if you put the jet data in, you get a bigger gluon at high x. And then you see this sort of offset of about between, let's say, 5 and, well, about 5% for nearer 10% for the up quarks, and a little bit less for the down quark. Now, that, when you come to predict W at LHC, that is really going to matter, right? Because that is a big difference in the quarks at this sort of X range that the LHC would probe in a W or Z cross-section, okay? So the point is, we better understand that, I think. Now, partly it is driven, I think, you can see one other feature here, the gluon. See, if you don't have to have as much gluon out here, because you don't want to fit the jet data, you can have more glue in here. And if you kind of have more glue in here to get a slightly better fit to the F2 data from Hera, you'll get bigger quarks. So these quarks are bigger, I think, probably because the gluon is bigger there, and that traces back to the jet data not being in the fit.
So down there, gluons and quarks are coupled together.
Very much so.
Strong evolution.
At this Q squared, very much so. Right. Right. There's one other thing I want to mention here, because, as I said, there's lots of interesting things to say. Look at U-bar and D-bar down here, bang on top of each other in both cases. U-bar, D-bar here, very different. Now, it's often said that the gold-plated, the most precise thing that a theorist can predict at the LHC is the ratio of W plus W minus cross-sections, right? You often heard that I've said that, right? The ratio of W plus to W minus, it's 1.4 or something at the LHC. And the reason I think we all think it's a very, very, very precise thing is that lots of things cancel in that ratio. Sergei's prediction for W plus to W minus ratio would see the difference between the U bar and the D bar. And it would be many standard deviations away from my prediction.
This is not in the region of W Z user
production. At the LHC?
Yeah,
the LHC, it's in here. That's right. Big difference.
But when you evolve to Q squared, so to 64.
This is high.
Oh, this is
high. Yeah, okay. This is it, right. So I don't have any answer to that, but I'm just saying these things matter, right? You know, something as simple as the jet data is not in my fit can percolate through and say my W cross-section is very different. So those are the sort of things that worry me. Now, just want to say one thing about the MRST. I said the MRST gluon and the CTEC gluon are slightly different at small x. The MRST gluon is smaller. Why? Because our parameterization allows the thing to go negative. And the CTEC one, it has to have a positive gluon. So a subtle difference, right? It's just a different assumption. They say the gluon should be positive. We say, well, maybe it isn't. Okay, we go ahead, we do the fit. And again, we can trace that difference right the way through to the W cross-section at the LHC. That simple assumption goes right the way through. Our gluon is always smaller than the CTEC one at small x. It never catches up.
But the negative gluon you could check already against the longitudinal structure function data. Yes.
You can, well, you could if you had FL data at small x.
Yeah.
Well, and the errors are like that.
No,
I really don't think so. I think so. Right. There's two things I would say. I mean, these predictions, I believe that there are serious problems with the stability of the perturbation series for FL at small x. Right? Second point, H1 haven't measured it. Indirectly.
Okay, let me answer to this point. I mean, you wrote this paper where you did this study, but what you used were these approximations,
coefficient functions
of the longitudinal structure function. And these coefficients were obtained from fitting to fixed moments. So
yes.
Then you get fitting to these fixed moments, you get a well-constrained form of, if you make certain assumptions in a large expansion.
Mm-hmm.
But you do not get a very well constrained form of
small x, right.
Right, yeah.
So there's a big uncertainty in the prediction.
There is a big uncertainty in the parameterization which you get out of this fit to the nullimum. So if you take this uncertainty into your study for the longitudinal structure function, then you would have to blow up basically the error band,
yes.
Which you come up with in the end.
Yeah.
To a much larger extent than you
did. That's a fair comment.
Yeah.
But
so
it means I'm not, that I can't throw out this, I'm not going to throw out this fit because the error band for the prediction for FL is so big.
No, but it's not about perturbative stability in the first place. It's because you're still lacking knowledge on the exact functional
right.
form. Yeah.
Yeah, but I was more mentioning the stability. I was referring to the fact that my LO gluon, my NLO gluon, my NNLO gluon are going like that.
Yeah, but you should also, in the end, you should deliver a prediction for the structure function FL, which is positive,
right.
Because after all, we talk about.
That's right. Well, okay. Look, the point, I only wanted to make the point on this, that we, in fact, on the next slide, you'll see, here's the error, it's the same figure, but now here's the MRST error band, and yes, indeed, the MRST error band does include the CTEC one, and we can have a positive one, it's not a big deal. But.
So when does the gluon go positive?
At around Q squared of 2 or 3. So, again, we can...
It's not a big problem to calculate for the FL, right?
Hmm?
You always can check what is the FL.
Yeah. The point I just wanted to make is that a little assumption can have big effects. I don't want to keep detaining you much longer. Here's the other one where I think is sort of interesting. This is U bar minus D bar, or D bar minus U bar times X. And this is again off the shelf, so it's CTEC. This is completely wrong, right?
Okay.
Sorry. Sergei's is blue, and CTEC is green. Stupid error in the program. All right. So because it has to be that, because CTEC and MRST, the same data are in the fit determining this quantity. It's the Drell-Yan data and the NMC data.
Just because in MRST and CTEC, you just impose
a
condition.
Is right.
The difference goes to zero for this reason.
Well, not quite. I would disagree with that comment, but because the Drell-Yan data seems to me to suggest that, but I firmly believe that x times d bar minus u bar goes to zero because of Reggie arguments. Now the DIS fit doesn't tell you that, right?
Yeah. In fact, if you add errors to this distribution, you will find
right.
that my determination is comparable to zero.
Just about. I don't.
That this way is much more smart because. In this case, you can quantify uncertainties in this region, which is not supported and tracked by data.
No, but I don't think so. I think that it's smarter to make the reasonable assumption that the things do go to zero.
Eventually, if you do believe that you have this difference constraint to zero, you can put additional constraint.
No, but I think it's physics. I think it does. I mean, I think the parameterization should. Basically allow it to go to zero and then you can decide how fast it goes to zero. It's just my prejudice, right? The data, you see, and I'm kind of using data. See, here's Drell-Yan data, which is in my fit, and it's not in Sergei's fit. And it's sort of supporting, this is without the X, but I get some comfort for the fact that this seems to be telling me that x times, well, this is d bar minus u bar, it's sort of heading up to a constant, right? Now, I can't say that it doesn't do that or that it doesn't do that, but this is somehow reinforcing my prejudice about this quantity.
If you could say these errors, how
very, very big. Sergei's errors sort of come up here, but I think that there's a deeper reason for this difference, and that is that in Sergei's fit, d bar is parameterized as constant over x, or x to the minus something, and u bar is parameterized as a different constant over x. And when you do the fit, you get different numbers over x, let's say in each case. And therefore, they go off to infinity just with different normalizations. Whereas in our fit, that can never happen, because the difference is forced by the parameterization to vanish. So it's another example of the effect of the parameterization, which is our prejudice, on the output distributions. And again, you will see that, well, I said this already, sigma w plus over w minus will test this, right? Because we're going to get very different, I think, ratios of w plus w minus at the LHC. And so my band is going to be, my band is tiny on that.
They go in the same way or the opposite direction?
Well, this is at the LHC, a U bar will make a W minus, and a D bar will make a W plus.
You also mentioned, well, another mention out there's a difference from the valence differences as well.
No, because the valence is it's U D bar divided by D U bar, and for me, I can't, in my way of doing it here, I just cancel D bar over U bar, they're the same, and therefore the only thing that the ratio depends on is the D to U ratio at reasonably high X, where we'd all agree that the NMC proton to deuteron data pinned down the U to D pretty well. So we will find that the valence part of that ratio is known to within a percent or two, and then the difference is all coming from what's... Yeah.
Well, here's an example about, in principle, you can choose the parameterization any way you want. But in practice, we are doing a study which comparing theory with experiment, and there are theory inputs and experimental inputs, and therefore you need to optimize those. Mm-hmm. Like, you have the choice of parameterizing U bar and D bar separately,
mm-hmm.
or you can choose to parameterize U bar plus D bar and U bar minus D bar separately. Now, they are equivalent, mathematically, they are equivalent. But physically, it just seems to make much more sense if you parameterize U bar plus D bar and U bar minus D bar, or their ratio separately, because at small x, those are controlled. There are some physics input there.
But if you don't have the physics input,
yeah.
You only make that argument if you have the physics input,
yeah.
Which is what we do.
Yeah.
Well, but Sergei doesn't.
Yeah, I mean,
so it's a different way of doing it. Mathematically equivalent, but the results are very different in practice.
Right, but the question is,
Okay.
Because you don't have infinitely accurate data, then what's a more efficient way of
right.
Yeah.
Okay. Sergei mentioned his strange distribution, and he talked about a plus or minus 10%. 10%, no, I shouldn't say, but Sergei will have a 25% on that. So if I take a 25% plus or minus uncertainty on that, I get some band down here. CTEC and MRST strange quarks are, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 sigma away. Right? So one has to be very careful. You will see the impact of that on sigma W at the LHC. Now, I don't know whether it's 0.5% or 1% or 2%, but there will be a difference in the predicted cross-sections coming from this plot.
James, actually, how do you fix your strange quark distribution?
Right. Well, I think the issue, I don't know. I mean, we all kind of are in the business of fixing the, going back to the dimuon data, and this 0.42 that Sergei mentioned. So I don't really understand this, because if we all use 0.42, Why are these differ by a factor of 3?
It's really clear. In fact, because I use this suppression factor at Q square equal to 20 GV, which is average. use this suppression factor at Q squared equal to 20 GV, which is average Q squared for the CCFR Newtek experiment, which is used to constrain this ratio. And this quantity is given for if you calculate suppression factor of Q squared equal to 4 as a given in your plot, it must be less. Evidently, this is just clear property.
Yeah, but I know, but the distributions are very different.
I'm just finishing. Yeah.
But so
I checked. We discussed this point a couple of weeks ago. I checked that your parameterizations are comparable with this suppression factor 0.42, but at this
right.
scale.
So,
are comparable to this suppression factor of Q squared.
I know, but there are dimuon.
Which is more correct. Right.
No, but there are dimuon data, and we fit them, and they fit them, and I don't understand why if we fit the same data.
You can check them.
Yeah, I can be. I fit the data, right? It's in the paper.
I communicated to you that you can check that here for your PDF suppression factor of Q squared equal to 4 is about 2.4.
No,
it is about 0.4.
But I'm saying that there are data from CCFR.
Which is an evident disagreement to the experiment.
Well, I mean, given the amount of work we've done, I just cannot believe that if you use the charge current data alone, that, you know, with the kind of constraint it has on screen, that you would assign 25% error bank.
I don't get it from charge score for charge current. First of all, I use neutral current, and secondly, I use it as external input.
So here is something that
uncertainty from the data.
Okay, there's a clear disagreement here, and if I'm 5 sigma, no, I shouldn't say that. But this is something I think this week we can hope to resolve, right?
James, let me ask you again: what is your proposal? What we should do in general?
There are dimuon data, right?
Yeah.
They're published as cross sections, and we should at least attempt to fit those cross sections. It's not easy because they measure muons. We've got to do S goes to charm, and charm goes to Ds, and Ds goes to muons, and all that stuff. It's a big mess. But hidden in that data is information about this quantity.
So you do all this fragmentation and charm and these things included?
Well, what we did was we fitted to the data on S of X provided by the experiment. Now, maybe that's a slightly dangerous thing to do.
Okay.
Wiki at the moment is fitting the cross sections because they've got a nice program which takes them from S to C to D to mu, blah, blah, blah. And one should do it, right? And when one does it, one will see the answer to this problem. And maybe one will only see the answer when one does that.
The answer is actually to our surprise. This 0.4, this suppression factor of 0.4 or so at Q squared equal to 2 is quite robust.
Right.
But
it should be changed.
No. What should change? I mean, I fit it.
Just because if you perform backward evolution from high Q squared to low Q squared, in equal amount you extract portions of
No.
All right. Okay, let's move on, and I want to finish. I mentioned this thing about the tensions between the jet and the I've already talked about this last week. It may be if you put the jets in with the DIS, there's a slight tension. And it may be that the jet cross sections are wrongly measured somehow by CDF and D0, and that they should not be in the fit. And if they aren't in the fit, they'll get what Sergey gets. But at the moment, they are in our fit, and we see, both CTEC and MRST, a slight tension between the two data sets. And in one word, everybody wants too much glue. The DIS wants glue at small x, and the jet wants glue at high x. And we just simply did the exercise that I talked about last week and saying, well, suppose that the jet was right and the small x stuff was wrong. Why? Because there was extra theory in the small x. So you were just misleading yourself fitting NLOD glap to small x DIS data because there was all these log 1 over x around. Right? Now that, a priori one can't say that isn't the case, right? I believe. And it may well be that will be the resolution of this tension, that eventually the small x quarks and gluons will be shown to be different from the ones we have now. I don't know. anyway, the point of this was to do the exercise, and I'll just, I mean, the only thing to note is that when you remove the small XDIS data from the fit, the gluon goes even more negative. It says, great, I don't have nothing to fit down here. Nothing to fit. I can be as negative as I want. A zero. I mean, it wants to be, not negative, it wants to be small. It doesn't want to be there at all. So by removing the data down here from the fit, more glue here, more glue here, that's great.
So what is the insert in the NLO band?
Oh, there's no band here. It was just a... There's no data down here.
No, but from the evolution.
Hmm?
From the evolution.
What is... So what do you mean?
It's a screw square.
This...
You got that using NNLO evolution.
No, it's the sole Vogt van Neerven moment,
yeah,
blah,
I mean,
blah, 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 error band, absolutely.
This blows up at small x.
Absolutely, yeah. No, so Wookie, no, Sergei showed the fact that there is a, yeah, I mean,
yeah.
There's a big uncertainty because we don't yet, you haven't yet finished the calculation, right? But I don't haven't even put, I could have put, you know, Andreas and they put some kind of A, B, I forget
yeah,
what it was
well,
called. Well,
this is complex. This is just guides the eye.
Yeah.
It's funny to believe in this picture because you know that, in fact, it was demonstrated in the paper by Wolf that impact of the NLO corrections on the splitting function is not so large. It's at the level of several percent. You obtain qualitative difference between NLO and NLO.
Yeah.
How can it be?
But that's a definite feature because this guy has more higher order terms. One of our x, it's the stuff that's in the splitting and coefficient functions at small x are making a difference. And that's why I asked you about the quality of fit. We get easy. We find it easier
also,
to fit with NLO.
It's also
at
the level of 5%.
No.
I can show the picture.
We get a better fit at NLO. At small x. Not much better, but a little bit better. Because we find that somehow the NNLO splitting functions give you more enhancement to the speed of the evolution, and you don't need as much glue. So it's just a little bit better.
Well, I would like to just to stress that the difference qualitatively, this it's very difficult to understand this result. The result, if you remind about paper by Walker. Because, in fact,
careful. They started with the same partons, right? You've got to be careful. They started from the same set of partons at Q0 and evolved them in the two different ways. That's not what you're supposed to do.
Several percent, how can you eventually get so large difference between NLO and
NLO? The vote thing was comparing what happens if you start from the same things and evolve in the two different ways. This is starting from very different things, because that's what the fit wants. And
I can imagine. You cannot say you just start there and it has to be back exactly because it's probably, you know, there's a lot of subtleties.
So I think this is my final remark that you can go back. This is just, we did this as an exercise. Robert Thorne, our collaborator, is very keen on these log x's at small x, and he has various resummed, improved splitting functions, all that stuff. But an exercise of just throwing in a couple of terms like this, you get back, you recover a good fit with fitted numbers A and B of order one. So the fact that I can improve a fit by putting in the sort of stuff that I know is in there anyway seems to us suggesting that maybe there is this extra contribution going on. And we see it because of this tension. Or no, we're led to it because of the tension. Now, as I say, if you throw away the jet data at large x, okay, you can get a good fit with A and B equals zero. You don't care, roughly.
So is there any data that would shed some light, like the jet data at HERA? I think as far as trying to, quantitatively or?
It's not small enough x.
The question to be asked, like, they're comparing the next leading order distribution with the leading function which we know, but it's one expense of the next leading order we know also. I mean, this is basically this Katami, Chapioni, et al. They would look like a little bit different. and Andreas and myself into the subleaving terms.
Yeah, yeah.
So this seems to be a model which is different from.
Well, look, this wasn't intended. At this order in the true splitting function, you find a term like this, right?
But we have a 1 over x also.
Of course, 1 over x is missing.
There's some 1 over x. Missing.
It should be x times.
Oh, x. Yeah, okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
So I don't know. If you say this, if you say to people, if you say to this, put this in a talk with here experimentalists, you tell them they've done a fantastic job in measuring F2 so precisely that maybe finally we're now seeing these terms. You know, but as I say, that's all I have to say.
Yeah, just to try to pin these things down with data in small x itself, it would be the phenomenology.
It would be impossible because he gets a perfectly good fit without having them in. Or if he put them in, he'd get a slightly different fit. It wouldn't be any better.
But then, of course, you know, if you have to, because now you get a good leverage on here with the improvements. Yes. That seems to be very powerful, but also it raises another theoretical question. You know, just as you say, gluons can perfectly become negative, you know, but also at some level you will have to start questioning some rules. Because then when you have some rules, this leverage arm is gone again. But once you put in, you know, like higher twist terms and other corrections, target mass corrections, and so on and so forth, these some rules got modified. The universality, you know, everything. It's a very non-trivial game.
The other thing I should say is that I call these NNLO fits, but they're not, right? They're not for two reasons. They're not because we're only using this moment stuff, and secondly because we're fitting up to now both the Drellian and the jet data at NLO. And if the NNLO correction to the jet data turned out to be really large and positive, then we'd be back to a small gluon at high x. And we'll be back to exactly the sort of fit that Sergei's doing. Right? If it's large and negative, so we need an even bigger gluon.
So better to wait for the new.
So better to wait.
What's the results in the threshold resummation?
Just very little.
Very little change, yeah.
So it had been done for the central region before, and then for this project paper, we did it for the forward region as well. That was just, you know. Yeah, that's right.
It
just doesn't have any major impact.
I think the Drellian data is a real. I mean, we can put that in, and I think we, you know, that's will change things a bit, and it should go in there. And I don't see any problem with putting it in. Apart from the fact that some of that, if you look back into the Drellian data, it's not some of it's pretty old, and it's not clear that they knew, they cared, or knew, or were worried too much about the systematic errors.
No, there's no information on systematic errors.
So here is the thing, you know, here's a problem for the statistical people. What do you do with Drellian data when you read the paper and you say, we don't have any systematic errors, or it could be 5%, or it could be 10%, and these experiments are finished?
Unless you make something up for your systematic errors,
and then you don't include it. But then, you know, these guys have worked hard to do this correction.
That's not my problem.
There are more recent data, yeah.
Well, maybe I should